Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. And I'm your host for the next hour and a half. I'm Dale Graham. Welcome back to Masonic Home Companion. Thank you for joining me. Wouldn't be the same without you, would it? Somehow I managed to struggle through the week with a lot of your following your advice, and I'm most appreciative. I couldn't possibly function without the brethren around me. Of course, then again, I couldn't possibly be a Mason without you. So, this is the 4th of August. It's good to be alive, isn't it? We are so blessed in our situations. This is the 216th day of the year. That's pretty exciting. You know what? The exciting part of it? We have the Perseids coming up. Just in a few days, we're going to have a new moon on August 8th. And that has some relevance because the history of Masonry and the symbolism of the moon. Some of you will already... I'll talk about that in just a second. But on the 6th, the moon will, of course, be directly between the Earth and the Sun, and it won't be visible from Earth. If you're out there, United Time, 21:51 in the morning, this is the best time of the month to observe faint objects, look at the galaxies and stars, because there won't be any moonlight to interfere. Now, the exciting part of that is the Perseid meteor shower. Now, that's something that starts around the 17th of July every year and goes to about the 20th this year, to about the 24th of August. And it's caused by a comet. It's all that matter that's dragged along. It's the Swift-Tuttle comet, by the way, for those of you who are really interested. We can expect it peaks about the 11th of August, 11th and 12th of August, that's why. So if you're out there on a clear night, take a look. Just close your eyes, sit out there for maybe, you need 10 minutes to get your eyes adjusted. Get a comfortable chair so you can lean back a little bit and take a look. You should see about up to 60 meteors an hour. That's like one a minute, and they come in clusters. They don't come regulated like some compulsive little activity. The Perseids produce a large number of bright meteors. The shower runs annually, and it peaks this year on the night of the 11th. That changes, of course. Over the time, the first quarter moon will set shortly before midnight, leaving dark skies for what should be an excellent show. So remember, the quarter moon, it does reflect a considerable amount of light, but it'll set. So, make it a later night. Huh? Best viewing will be from a dark location after midnight. Meteors will radiate from the constellation Perseus, but can appear anywhere in the sky. So that'll give you a little bit. Of course, we won't have the full moon until the 21st of August, but we'll talk more about that. That's when the moon is directly opposite the Earth from the Sun and fully illuminated. Anyway, it is sort of spellbinding for some of us to think about what the moon does. I stumbled across an article, of course, from the Grand Lodge of British Columbia and the Yukon. If you haven't seen their website, do yourself a tremendous favor and just check it out. It's a wonderful source of information. And looking at a little article, an interesting article from the Grand Historian of the Grand Lodge of Vermont. You're going to hear me picking on Grand Historians more, partly because our good friend and well-respected Masonic brother, Michael Jenkins up in Ottawa, has the Grand Historian, is a prolific writer and has given us so much material, but it's relatively obscure, and it's exciting. If you've ever had the opportunity to be in his company, is just an enthusiastic thinker. It's wonderful. So this is from James P.W. Goss. He said, there's no more spectacular reminder of our Masonic history and ritualistic heritage than the moon at its height of fullness. While astronomers view the moon with the analytical eye of science, the moon has been a focal point for cultures around the world throughout history and has inspired music, poetry, and religion alike. However, for Masons, and particularly, you can tell he's from Vermont Masons, the moon has not just been a symbolic light in our ritualistic teaching, but also a literal light to our brethren of long ago. It thus behooves us to take a moment to remember the moon and its long association with the craft and its origins. Our direct tradition regarding the moon begins with the ancient Hebrews. In Genesis 1, verses 14 to 19, we are told that on the fourth day of creation, God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. Despite the specific prohibitions against lunar worship in Deuteronomy and the Book of Kings, that has to do with maybe a little bit of competition when Christianity wasn't formed, it was trying to make its footprint at a time when there were a number of people. It came out of a time when there were a number of people claiming to be the Messiah. So anyway, there were prohibitions written into Scripture. The moon was still regarded as a strong symbol of permanence and regularity associated with its usage to measure the passage of time before we had watches and clocks. And in fact, the monthly offerings to the moon found in Numbers 28, 11 to 15 are still read in some Jewish synagogues. It is from the medieval European science of alchemy that the first uses of the moon in the graphic and ritualistic manner that Masons are accustomed to are driving their meaning. The alchemists were a group of mystics who first appeared in the 12th century and were the forerunners of our modern chemists, and I might say perhaps physicists. But they believed that with the proper mixture of chemicals and methods, base metals such as iron and lead could be turned into gold and silver. Beyond this, however, the alchemists were true philosophers who used symbols and were drawings extensively in their teachings, and who insisted on strict secrecy from their initiates. Much of the graphic symbolism used in masonry, such as images of the plum, the square, the level, rough ashlar, and perfect ashlar, were taken from alchemical texts. To the alchemists, the moon was a symbol of the metal silver and was used to depict that substance in the obscure writings which transmitted their secret formula. One of the most prevalent images used by alchemists was the stylized drawing of the sun and the moon with human faces. These images are now associated with the Masonic Tracing Board of England and monitors of such American Masonic ritualists as Jeremy Cross, who lectured in the Lodge of Vermont in 1815. It is the craft ritual and the structure of the Masonic Lodge itself that we must bring together all of the foregoing elements to give a true picture of the use of the moon in masonry. In modern American ritual, the primary reference to the moon is as the second of the lesser lights of masonry. This modern usage follows the early 18th century English ritual reference of the three lights of this lodge being the sun, the moon, and the master mason. In addition to these movable lights, there were also three in these early English lodge rooms, three fixed lights, which are described by some Masonic historians as three windows in the lodge room to light men to, at, and from their work. These three windows were later replaced with three candles located in the east, south, and west corners of the lodge. and situated before the master, junior warden, and senior warden, respectfully. The reference to the sun, moon, and master of the lodges, three lesser lights of masonry, and their particular association with these three burning tapers and the associated officers, was developed by the so-called ancient Grand Lodge, which was active in England from the mid to late 18th century. The ancients, who apparently consisted of Masons hailing from Scotland and Ireland, were at odds with another faction of Masons in England, the so-called Premier Grand Lodge. The ritual of the Premier Grand Lodge only referred to three great lights, without the ancients' reference to the three lesser lights. The fact that the ancients held to the above interpretation of the three lesser lights was particularly significant for American Masonry, as was their use of deacons in their work, degree work, as we shall see. Let us think about where this came from. Remember the deacons? We can accredit, if you want, when you look around, you're next in your room and you're paying a bit of attention, take a look around. And these are elements that, they're more than this, but these are elements that we can trace and see have to do with the that notion of the ancients. Anyway, I'll leave you there. Go and check this out in under the Grand Lodge of British Columbia and Yukon. Incredible bit of work. And the author's name is James P.W. Goss. And it's called, the article is called The Moon in Masonic History. I thought you might like it. I found that fascinating when I came across it the other day. It's not to be dismissed, I would say, particularly for lodges like there were that held meetings that were often calculated on days about or relative to the full moon. Lots to do. We're going to talk a little bit. I've had some requests to revisit some work that was actually a big part of the content of Masonic Home Companion when we started back in December of 2010. Yeah, it's been that long. And so I'll talk to you a little bit about that. We'll get into today we're going to revisit some of the work included in that as two volumes of Freemasonry through six centuries. I found that particularly fascinating. And then we'll wrap up with, maybe we should get into a little bit of Montaigne. Not that I've forgotten our old friend William Leslie Wormshurst, who seems to have an uncanny knack of having spoken to things relevant throughout Masonry. You're sitting back in your comfortable chair. I hope you have the lights turned down to just the right level, or candles burning around you, or whatever. You set the mood, and we'll sit down and talk as serious-minded Masons, Freemasons. Today, we're going to hear more and more about the things that a new way of thinking about Freemasonry, that a new perspective, just on an old order. We're going to talk about, I think the pendulum swing. You know, with anything, we sort of try and attempt things well-intended. History tells us whether, our attempts are productive and where we have to modify them, as we always do. And now we've passed that point where we think of whether we should, revisit our roots or try and examine some of the tensions and pressure points within Masonry. Well, of course, we've done that. That's been decided some time ago, collectively, by all of us. Now the question leads us to what to do. And you can tell that I've been a strong proponent of education as the source of investigation, and now I'll add research. That's why I think the reliance on our historians is vital to help us understand the philosophy of Freemasonry, because unless we do, you and I can't possibly pass it on to the next generation. And the men that came before us, unless they were profound thinkers, can only give us an approximation, a partial version of what Freemasonry was originally intended to be, to allow us that banquet of ideas so that you and I can sift, pick through, translate, and interpret in our own way, so that we, at the end of our duty to Freemasonry, have this sense that we've carried on the important elements. Well, we can't carry those on, gentlemen, unless we know what they are. Along the way, there are more than one set of opinions about this, but we have 400 or 500 years behind us or more, depending on how far your researches go. And that history helps us to develop facts. When we can see consistencies between different authors, we shouldn't be foolish enough to think that any one author has grasped it all. But when we start to cross-reference, then we can start to hold certain opinions or certain facts to have been without revision. History is prone to being revised, isn't it? Like, as he used to say, you know, history is written by the victor. It's not necessarily what happens. Here you are, brethren. This is how I describe you and me. Us. You can tell that I sat down and had a conversation with a very dear and very good committed Mason. I'll just say his name is Dave. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give away to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostures just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it all on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your long turn after you are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Rudyard Kipling. I expect that the audience of Masonic Home Companions includes quite a few contrarians, if you don't mind me saying so. So, knowledge comes, but wisdom lingers. Alfred Lord Tennyson tells us this. a lie, which is half a truth, is ever the blackest of lies. Words, like nature, half reveal and half conceal the truth. Guard your roving thoughts with a jealous care, for speech is but the dialer of thoughts. And every fool can plainly read in your words what is the hour of your thoughts. The happiness of a man in this life does not consist in the absence, but in the mastery of his passions. To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. My strength is as the strength of 10, because my heart is pure. All experience is an arch, where through gleams that untraveled world, whose margins fade forever and ever, when I move. Alfred Lord Tennyson. Interesting. Those little inspiring moments for yourself. No man ever got high by pulling other people down. The intelligent merchant does not knock his competitors. The sensible worker does not work those who work with him, does not work those. Don't knock your friends. Don't knock your enemies. And don't knock yourself. You see? Different spin, huh? Oscar Wilde says, a gentleman is one who never hurts anyone's feelings unintentionally. Experience is simply the name we give our mistakes. Man is least himself when he talks in his own person. Give him a mask, and he will tell you the truth. Every saint has a past. Every sinner has a future. I am so clever that sometimes I don't understand a single word of what I'm saying. We are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. Men always want to be a woman's first love. Women like to be a man's last romance. How's that? Education is an admirable thing, but it is well to remember from time to time that nothing that is worth knowing can be taught. All of a sudden, Oscar Wilde gets my attention. Whoa. Where do we go from there? Well, I'll tell you where we'll go from there. Let's take a look at what we've done with the work of Freemasonry through six centuries. Still with me, historians? Good. Good. And I've got a little bit of, there's some interesting things going on. I've got a copy of Masonic Wisdom. Where did I get this? That was from the Philately Society in London. Mine's a copy from 2002. And it's... maybe I will get into a little bit of that, but probably not today. Did I mention that I've been absorbed by the work of Andrew Hammer? The challenges that he puts forth and the reminders that if we're honest with ourselves as Masons, as men, and we look around, have we created the atmosphere of Freemasonry in our lodges? Now, I know there's quite a bit of concern about the attrition. Our membership in Ontario has dropped, and I think likely it will continue to drop. But again, we seem to be focusing on the wrong end of the issue. It's like having a formula, and we work through the computations and come up with an answer that's incorrect, and then we focus on the incorrect answer. Well, look at the formula that's led to that. I claim that when somebody comes to us and opens themselves to the initiation of Freemasonry. If we haven't done our work as Masons, not him, if we haven't done our work, it's not him that's the problem. If we haven't prepared him for what he's going to at least roughly experience, not to say that we're going to tell him what's going on, but we can candidly and honestly say, when you step into this, it's about trust and it's about a lifetime commitment. And what do we hear? We talk as if, yes, we are all in the gutter. We minimize, we're not authentic and we're not real. I've heard a fellow senior Mason claim very openly that Freemasonry is a Christian organization. Far from it. Where did that come? You know, just spinning it, just making it up. And then getting huffy when that was challenged. There is a problem that we have, lack of consistency between us. Not to say we all have to be in lockstep and only saying one person's opinion. But it's important to be authentic. To tell somebody it's a minimum amount of commitment, well, it's not. It starts off that way, but it's not a minimum amount of commitment. And it takes time. How much time? Enough. Enough time. And if you aren't comfortable with that type of, if you need something more closely defined, Freemasonry is not for you, that fella. It's not for you. It's not for me. If you think it's a joke and a good time, what has given that person who says that the right to redefine Freemasonry on behalf of us all? You take a symbolic and philosophical order that's been in existence for hundreds of years and you're saying that it's a good time. The good time is when you do the work properly. That's what we teach. When you make effort and you persevere, instead of apologizing for somebody that has a half-baked a delivery of something. Well, this is just nonsense. And it's not Masonic. It's not Freemasonry. It's some one person's opinion. Freemasonry is certainly beyond that. And so a person might want to join the club and be able to sit down and have, you know, the emphasis at every, when we walk away, if the emphasis is on, you know, a hastily prepared meal that's given very little thought. If that's what people remember, then why go through all the rest? Truly, why? Because you can get that in a restaurant. If I want to have fun, I'll go to a movie. Does that have to do with Freemasonry? Make it a yuck? Minimize it? Act as if anything that is educationally focused or philosophical is uncomfortable? Where in the world did that come from? How? And if you find yourself or anybody finds himself in that situation, it's not to say, oh, I don't belong. It's to say there's a challenge. There's work to be done. And you know it. And it's expected. It's expected. When you accept the obligations, you accept that you're going to work, and you convey that in your effort. So by me saying that passing the inferior work of an apprentice, what I'm truly saying to that man and to all that witness it is, and my work is inadequate, so I'll expect you to do the same. I'll cover up your mistake. You cover up mine. You and I play off key, but we'll pretend that it's on key. And so it goes, and so it goes. It's not admonishing. It's not a criticism. These are, I think, observations. So, again, think of the atmosphere. Freemasonry has it all. It is a universe of ideas inside a universe of curiosity. And we seem to focus on what? Friction? Conflict that makes us feel so uncomfortable we can't talk. Oh my goodness. we seem to focus on the unbridled passions by men who have not learned to control themselves. So what do? They create, that creates mischief, and we go and focus on it. And if that's not enough, we focus on governance. Oh. So quite right, when you're there to have fun and you're there to think only about governance and money, you know, how things are run, then of course a meeting is going to be full because it goes on and it's boring. How many lodge meetings do you hear that go on at least 45 minutes to 60 minutes of absolute nonsense? Although saying, well, we want to get together after, but stretch everything out. Stretch everything out because somebody likes to carry on and ignore the fact that you've got people that have been there sitting for, what, a couple of hours? Gee, how genuine can you be? The truth around Freemasonry is ugly because it's unvarnished. Unvarnished truth is what we have to work with. Not about me. You read this from Brother Hammer has pulled some of this observation from the work of William Preston back in the 18th century. It's important that it's hard. It's hard to make these adjustments. It's not supposed to be easy. It requires flexibility and deeper change than we might care to give. We have to earn it. We have to want that. And if we need the purity of Freemasonry, we need the authenticity and commitment of Freemasonry, then we all need to want that. So our wants and needs become one. Freemasonry has offered that opportunity, but it's up to us. No more prancing. We're an interesting bunch. And we're getting there. We're getting there. In the meantime, let's show this respect it's due. Education is our future. Our history is our future. We need to get it. We need to get it defined and understood. We need more of you developing expertise in a particularly unique perspective on Freemasonry, and to teach other people. And if you do it in a boring way, the room's going to clear. Nobody will invite you back. Then before you get pull your lip off the floor, sulking about it, go dig into some of Dale Carnegie's work. Learn how to do a proper presentation. Because the fact is, if we can suck up our ego and not be wounded every time we do a terrible job and somebody actually says, well, gee, that sucked, that was terrible. Well, the truth is, you may have something and probably do have something very important to say. Well, how am I ever going to know if you can't get over yourself? I need to hear your ideas. I need to experience it. But in truth, you have to help make it accessible. If you make your work so boring that I fall asleep, well, man, you know, what do you want me to do? Apologize for being up from 5 o'clock in the morning? No. Make it exciting enough and accessible enough that I couldn't possibly. I have to fight to sleep. Warm room, sitting in a tuxedo, easy to go. So that's the kind of help I need from you, brethren. If you're worried about over-engineering it, go to it. Over-engineer it. We'll help you. We'll be supportive. But make the work accessible all the time. Believe in yourself, above all. Believe in yourself. But don't be walking around expecting somebody to praise work that's, you know, we're not going to discourage you. But getting constructive criticism is not discouragement. That's the truth. And there's a difference between somebody's vitriolic opinion, you know, somebody that's just mean-spirited. You stay away from those people. They're fools. they're useless. They're talking to themselves. If they're just spiteful and they're talking to you, if you hear somebody just spiteful and talking smack, as even Obama says these days, he's talking smack about somebody else, he's going to talk smack about you and me. But he's also going to be talking smack about himself. Sad character. That's the truth. You can be a Freemason, but you're still a man. Let's talk about some of the working conditions and wages. We did talk about that, didn't we? And we talked a bit about the early, some work by Fort. So I want to talk to you today about a statute. Do you mind? Can we get into that? I take that silence as a yes. Thanks. Remember we were talking about some of the work that was purported to be done by Henry VI and rewritten by John Locke and sent to the Earl of Pembroke with a letter back in 1696. All of that, remember from last week? Well, dig into last week's show if you want to get a bit of that going on. And you remember I had skipped over part of the manuscript because it's written in Old English and it would be plodding to read through it. And, you know, because I'm familiar with the writing, the way the words were spelled, but it would be, I think, utterly painful to have to sit and listen to it. Manuscript does not purport to be in the hand of Henry. So I'm going to talk about something about Fort's work. And this is in his early History and Antiquities of Freemasonry. This is kind of interesting stuff, I think. Since the Freemasons were forbidden to convene as a body of artificers who performed their work in the secret recess of the lodge, strongly tiled to prevent any but the initiated from entering, they turned their attention to preserving the original framework of Masonry as a moralistic organization. Gould calls attention to the confusion that has crept into the discussion through the translation of the terms of the statute in general chapters assembled, as though it had read in general chapters and assemblies. In this way, the error was made of assuming that the general annual assemblies of the fraternity were referred to and prohibited. Gould construes the term chapters to mean conventicles or conspirations, and concludes the statute was merely aimed at confederacies or agreements by which the Masons sought to defeat the operation of the statutes of laborers, and not at the existence of the Society of Masons or their lawful annual general assemblies or other activities. That the Masons, as well as other crafts, evaded the statutes at every opportunity can scarcely be doubted, as the history of the frequent repetitions of the legislation and the well-known impossibility of controlling economic laws by which measures amply testify. It must be remembered that the Masons, as well as other crafts, considered that by long usage it had become their prerogative to fix their own wages and the terms of their employment as necessarily incidental to the management of the societies. And naturally enough, they recoil from any such arbitrary interference with their customary rights. Remember, this is a time when labor laws were starting to come in and caps were being placed by the king on wages. Not so for Masons. It seems, because of the antiquity of their practices. It seems, however, much beyond the known facts to assume or assert that this statute was intended to or did exterminate the societies of operant Masons. You know, by banning it, it was thought that, you know, away you go, no more organization. Even though such intention may have existed, that result would be by no means followed. It is more likely the only effect would be to drive the lodges into seclusion for a brief period. Everything would go underground. It's like, yeah, right, we're going to give up a couple of hundred years of our history because of that. Even though, you know, we didn't have perhaps the same so-called protections in the rule of law. Don't be thinking that the way that our governments are functioning and stretching and abusing laws is the way it was intended. No. We are a nation of laws, and eventually we can try and correct when we find the corruption. So neither was it, should we presume that our brethren would have been prosecuted, but much wiser just to be discreet about it.
Anyway, history has proven that they were. A main support for the extermination theory lies in the absence of records of English lodges prior to the 18th century, and the contrast of that situation with the abundance of lodge records in Scotland. But there are extraneous accounts of English lodges, and particularly Dr. Plott's estimate that they were spread over the nation. Furthermore, it is contrary to the experience of in history for so sporadic and temporary an effort as one statute to meet with such complete success. So, Mason's Marks, we'll talk a little bit. One of those curious, though not unprecedented, customs of the Freemasons was that of placing their marks upon the carved stones. The more remarkable fact is that this did not attract the attention of Masonic writers until the last century. For workmen have been accustomed to mark stones from ancient times. Thus, it is said that the Chaldeans marked their sun-dried brick with the name of the king and of the god to whom it was dedicated, and likewise the Assyrians, Babylonians, and the Egyptians. The Roman brick maker had his mark consisting of the figure of a god, a plant, or an animal, encircled with his name. Mason's marks have been found at Jerusalem, apparently placed on the stones in the Phoenician quarters, quarries, for the same marks are found at Sidon. Nor were marks peculiar to Masons, for the hallmark was the device of most medieval guilds, and in fact, between the 13th and 16th centuries, no less than a dozen statutes and ordinances are found requiring bakers, goldsmiths, silversmiths, weavers, fullers, tinkers, pewter makers, coopers, blacksmiths, bladesmiths, and braziers to place their mark upon their products. Almost every old edifice abounds with Mason's marks, but since the marks were usually placed on the surfaces buried in the mortar, they are seldom visible without removal of the stones. The marks on English and French buildings generally vary from 2 to 7 inches in length, those in Cologne from 1.5 to 2 inches. For the most part, marks are rather simple in design, consisting of from 2 to 6 straight lines and a corresponding number of angles, though occasionally more intricate designs and curved lines are found. The hourglass form is very common, and one resembling the capital N is found in Kilwinning Abbey, Canterbury, and elsewhere. It is said that in the Reims Cathedral, the lowest stones forming one of the arcades are marked with the outline of a shoe sole, the stones above it with 2 and 3 row with 3, and so on around the arcade. The same marks were found in Strasbourg. Two marks not infrequently appear on the same stone, one possibly being that of the first carver, and the other that of the inspector. The five-pointed star, the Greek cross, and marks resembling the letters A, R, and W are among the most widely dispersed. Those resembling letters were not, however, the initials of names, as no custom of this kind has been traced, and of course would not provide the necessary distinction. Nor do the marks, to any considerable extent, resemble objects or otherwise give evidence of symbolical significance, though some have pretended to read mythological or symbolical meaning into them. The consensus of opinion among authorities is that they were purely devices of utility, the purpose being simply to distinguish the stone as the product of a specific mason. It was the custom in Scotland for the members of lodges signing the roster or other documents of the craft to affix their marks. This applied also to the non-operative or gentleman masons, such as of those who selected his mark, or gentleman masons, each of whom selected his mark. These resembled those found on stones and appeared to have no symbolical significance, though in a few instances the theoretics adopted some mark represented their trades, for example, shears for a tailor. Aberdeen Lodge kept a register of marks up to 1781. The law of St. Ninian's Lodge in Brecon, Scotland, required every mason to register his mark and forbade him to alter it. It seems odd that the authors of the speculative rituals following the formation of the Grand Lodge of England did not make symbolical use of this custom, but it was not until the creation of the mark degrees that it was applied to make one of the most interesting of the degrees based on craft masonry. Interest in the general subject of marks was not shown until 1841, when an article by George Goodwin appeared in The Boat Builder. The author relates the astonishment of an old French priest to whom the marks on the walls of his church were shown, the cleric exclaiming, "I have walked through this church 4 times a day, 28 times a week for nearly 40 years, and never noticed one of them. And now I cannot walk anywhere but they flit into my eyes." Later, Monsieur Didron of Paris copied a great number of marks from European buildings and concluded that they could be classified into those made by the stonecutters, which consisted of symbols such as shoes, trowels, and mallets, and those of the overseers, which were generally monogrammic characters. E.W. Shaw collected 11,000 marks and professed his ability to distinguish between those of master masons, fellow crafts, and apprentices, and also those of hired workmen not of the guild. W.T. Creed recorded 316 specimens found in Carlisle Abbey alone. De Silva found 522 marks in Portugal. He concluded that the purpose was not symbolical, but to enable payments to be made to so large a number of workmen without mistakes. To know exactly those who had done the various duties assigned to them, the workmen shaped their blocks one after another, and to avoid confusion in their work, were in the habit of marking each block with a given sign as representing their signatures so as to show how much was due them. Patrick Chalmers, in 1850, was told by Scots Masons generally that marks probably had in earlier times a meaning now unknown, and that they were still regarded with a sort of reverence, that there was a rule that marks should have at least one angle, that the circle was to be avoided unless in combination with a line to form an angle, and that there was no class of marks set apart for masters or workmen, and that if two masons on the same job appeared to have the same mark, one of them for the time assumed the slight modification. Chalmers thought the masons' marks had some mystical meaning, but conceded that their primary purpose was simply to distinguish the work of individual masons. About masons' guilds, a great deal has been written about masons' guilds and the assumption that the medieval guild association organization extended through all trades, including the stonemasons. Gould, Mackay, and other authors recognize the analogies, which are undoubtedly considerable, without observing the differences between guild regulations and the customs of Freemasons. Too frequently appears that Masonic authors have observed analogies, overlooking the distinctions and sought interconnections between Freemasonry and other prior and contemporary institutions, rather than asking, what evidence is there of any interrelation? It's like saying, well, of course, everything's connected. You know, anything that you can think of historically must be connected with Freemasonry. Well, give us evidence to demonstrate that. That's the fact-based world that has always been the case. So let's see what they did with that. Fundamentally, the guild system was merely, well, my goodness, are we going to become more knowledgeable about something that's thrown around glibly? Uh-oh. That's going to make us contrarians, if nothing does. The guild system was merely one evidence or consequence of the universal disposition of all medieval governments, national and municipal, to control, direct, and restrict industry, trade, and commerce of all kinds. Monopolies were established by and for the profit of the crown. Some industries were forbidden to individuals and private associations. Voyages were limited. Ports were opened or closed, or seemed best to be best to the sovereign. Wages were fixed by law, and complete freedom of endeavor was scarcely known or contemplated by those who were the creators of wealth. Though the guilds were associations of manufacturers, merchants, or workmen and did much to shape their respective occupations, guild memberships were compulsory, and these bodies, when organized, were neither independent nor autonomous. The main purpose of them was to effect unified control over a whole craft or art so as to subject it to the ordinances of the city in which it operated. Consumer protection. Quality control. There you go. They were really municipal guilds for the accomplishment of political regulation and control. The most recent investigations of the relation between the Freemasons fraternity and the city, burg, or borough guilds were carried on by Knopp and Jones at the University of Sheffield, England, in their Introduction to Freemasonry, in which they state, the idea of the control of industry was almost universal in the latter Middle Ages, the authority seeking to supervise every branch of industry and trade. This they commonly did through the guild craft or mystery, which was an organization under the aegis of the municipality. Of those who followed a particular trade in a particular town, established in order to reconcile the conflicting interests of producers and consumers. This type of organization, however, was apparently not common among Masons. Nowhere except in London has it been possible to trace any Masons' craft ordinances before the 16th century. This is probably accounted for by the fact that craft guilds were municipal institutions, whose members were originally mostly little masters, or independent craftsmen carrying on business on a small scale. Whereas many stone buildings were erected outside the boroughs by employers conducting enterprise on a large scale by means of the labor of numerous wage earners. The mere fact that among Masons in the Middle Ages there may have been masters, journeymen, and apprentices, the three grades of workers ordinarily found in a craft guild, would not in itself be proof of the existence of a guild. Actually, the apprentice system was a late development amongst the Masons, and very limited in its application, as only masters appear to have had apprentices at this time, whereas the great majority of masters were journeymen, of Masons were journeymen. They proceed to point out that another craft, the traveling minstrels, whose occupation was otherwise quite different from that of the Masons, were also unorganized as a guild. But like the Masons, held annual assemblies attended by knights, squires, and burgesses, as described in the Regius and Cook manuscripts, for which practice no analogy is found in the craft guilds. Since it is inconceivable that the Mason's craft was not controlled in some manner, the craft guild not being adaptable to it, the Masons were probably regulated by annual assemblies and by the lodges, which enforced the customs of the craft. It is then said that diversity, rather than the uniformity which we actually find, would have characterized the Masons' guilds. And as a consequence, there would have been no well-defined institution out of which modern Freemasonry could have developed. There is a marked difference between the guild system and the self-regulation of the Freemasons. The distinction between varying local guild ordinances and the national customs of the Mason's craft, the purport and effect of the Gothic constitutions, particularly the legends of Æthelstein and Edwin, were designed to assert royal sanctions for their self-regulation, and the charges embrace such parts of the usual guild ordinances as the Masons cared to adopt. As stated by Knopp and Jones, the important effect of this was to bring about national unity instead of separation into borough and town guilds, from which no speculative or modern order would have been likely to spring. Now, the next portion that we can get into here is the Gothic constitutions. It's called the Gothic. The oldest writings extant appertaining to the Freemasons are the old legends and charges, commonly called the Gothic constitutions. That term was applied to them by Dr. James Anderson in his Constitutions of 1738, where in recounting the proceedings of the Grand Lodge for the first 6 years, he stated that in 1816 several old copies of the Gothic constitutions were produced and collated. Although Dr. Anderson had not given any prominence to Gothic architecture in his constitutions of 1723, during the following 15 years, he undoubtedly became aware of the fact that the oldest of these documents ranged back to the closing years of that style in which the Freemasons had specialized. Some authors prefer to use the term old charges or ancient charges. Yay! Man, am I getting old. Ancient seems new, those upstarts. Some authors prefer to use the term old charges or ancient charges, which is hardly descriptive, for they contain the legends as well. Others use manuscript constitutions of the British Freemasons, which is descriptive but unwieldy. It's a little chewy, a little over the top. The Regius manuscript, the very earliest of these days, and I say that and I know that there's some history behind it. Talk to Jenkins and the rest of the crowd, and he's going to very gently point out, Dale, you know, I don't subscribe to that because. So one of you that's done this piece of study out there, please, by all means, make your presentation lively and sensational. Learn how to do it so that I can follow it and help me learn about this. Okay? So I'll just skip over that. And I apologize, you know. Hiram will expel me from the lodge again. Hopefully I'll learn from my failings. My gosh. So the Regius manuscript, the very earliest of these documents. This is yummy, isn't it, huh? This is telling us you're walking around with your book of the Constitution and you check Section 6. Well, what do you see? Ancient charges. There you go. Now you want to know where they came from? How many people have been walking around saying, I didn't even know they existed? And then we do the talks on them and it's like, oh my goodness, this is fabulous. This is great. It's real. Yes, it is, gentlemen. Brethren, it's completely real. And this is like the ancients whispering in our ears, our ancient brethren talking to us. Now, do we pay attention? If we pay attention to nothing else in masonry, this is critical. This is critical. You place all your emphasis on governance and spending a penny or two here. Well, of course, we have that kind of accountability, but that's not what masonry is. It's not about accountability. It's about learning. We're in a learning environment. We're in an educational, philosophical environment aimed at moral development. You develop character. Is that not clear? I mean, how many more hundreds of years of literature and history do we have to have recorded and sent down to us before we pay attention? I'm stroking it here. I'm on behalf of all of those who have shaken their head and walked away from a lodge meeting and said, what the hell was that about? I'm apoplectic. You're right. What was it about? We have to get it right. Hang in there. Don't lose faith. Support. When you see somebody else that seems to get it and get it right, support them. Support them. Support the ideas. Have those thoughtful conversations, even when there's fools running around wanting to play. Give them some balloons or something to give them something to chew on. They'll go away. Keep at it. You know, set the model. Set the tone, see the atmosphere when you meet with each other, and be inviting. There's always be somebody that will be running around being a sort of an inauthentic version of a Mason who simply was never taught that this potential existed. So we have to be patient. Of course we do. Of course we do. This isn't about arrogance. But in the meantime, when you look at things, I don't think it's arrogant to shake your head and say, what in the hell was that about? It's like, man, this is, you should not, here, meet my declaration, me, you, the rest of us should not have to endure masonry. We should not have to endure poor work and excuses. We should not. Not in this, or, and we should not have to apologize for that. We've been doing this for hundreds of years, brethren. That day of apologizing for what we are, who are we going to apologize, who claims the right to demand an apology? We're not doing it right. Simple fact. We're not doing it. Are we giving it our best when we know what our best is? Are we getting the best mentoring? And do they have the best and the finest bits of information at their fingertips?
Well, expectations are changing. Young and old, the brethren are looking for that authenticity and sincerity. The rest doesn't matter. They've went through it, and thank goodness they did. They kept our order functioning. And now, it's not that we're suffering. We are correcting. Those things did not have any traction. The silliness of masonry, the trivialization of masonry, did not have any traction, and they die as well. They wither. There will always be samples of that, illustrations throughout lodges, but they wither because they don't have any validity. They don't have any validity because it just is satisfying in the moment. Oh, I want to play and I want to have a joke, and gee, you know, why are you expecting me to think seriously? Well, my goodness, the whole ceremony, the whole ritual, the symbolism is designed to do that. My question is, why are you here? If that's not what you want, I mean, there's got to be other organizations where you can go and have a beer and just chatter away and do good things. Do good things. There's lots of people, especially in Canada. We are famous around the world for being able to roll up our sleeves and help other Canadians, other peoples, other peoples. That's what we are. A nation. So what is the Masonic nation? Competition for that? No. We just have an old history. And we need to be able to respect it in our actions and our thoughts. The Regius, you've heard about that. That was sitting in a library. The royals had it and discovered it. It wasn't sitting there neglected on purpose. It was like, oh man, what's this? The very earliest of these documents contains writings relating to the fraternity of Freemasons, sometimes as the Halliwell manuscript, for the reason that as Masonic character, its Masonic character was first discovered by J.O. Halliwell Phillips, a non-Mason. It is written on vellum 4 by 5 inches in size and bound in Russian leather. That's tiny, eh? It rests in the British Museum, where for many years I was there. I didn't see it. I didn't know that. If any of you have been to the British Museum and you've seen it, let me know. Email me. You've got the email address. I'd love to see what this is. It is rests in the British Museum, for it has for many years been cataloged as a poem of moral duties, which aided in hiding its Masonic character in 1839. It bears no date, so that we are compelled to rely on the judgment of antiquarians, some of whom have ascribed it to the 14th century. That's 1300s, eh? Others to the first half of the 15th century. The date 1390 is often used. It displays features of a rude epic poem and was probably the work of a priest who had access to older Masonic documents. The title is in Latin, which translated reads, "Here began the constitutions of the art of geometry according to Euclid." The poem, a legendary history of Masonry, a code of morals, a code of bylaws, and a manual of etiquette, consists of 794 lines and may be divided into 6 subjects as follows. The legendary history of geometry or Masonry, similar to that contained in other Gothic constitutions discussed later. They're a little wordy, aren't they? 15 articles for the master and 15 points for the craftsman. An ordinance relating to assemblies. The legend of the 4 crowned martyrs, Ars Quattro Coronate. Rules of behavior in church. Rules of deportment and etiquette. Parts 1 to 3 inclusively are pure Masonic, purely Masonic. 4 is slightly so, but is not contained in other Gothic manuscripts, and 5 and 6 are not Masonic at all. A specimen of this discourse may be cited beginning with the line 55. Ha! Sharpen your pencils. I would suggest right now you're sipping something, at least either one of those very, very nice blended scotches or... in a little bit of that smooth, maybe even that smooth Irish whiskey. Well, just hands across the ancients. Eh? There we go with our Irish brethren. The clerk Euclid in this wise founded this craft of geometry in Egyptian land. In Egypt he taught it full wide, in diverse lands on every side.
many years afterward, I understand, before the craft came into this land. This craft came into England, as I now say, in the time of good King Æthelstan's day. He made them both hall and likewise bower and high temples of great honor, to deport him in both day and night, and to worship his God with all his might. It then proceeds to relate how Æthelstan sent about after masons and called an assembly of lords, dukes, earls, barons, knights, squires, and many more, and gave them charges as set forth in full, with partly modernized, but partly modernized to make them more readably understandable. To wit, thank you, boys, 15 articles for the master mason. Do I have time to go? Yeah, go through them here. He must be steadfast, trusty, and true. He must be at the general congregation to know where it shall be held. He must take apprentices for 7 years, his craft to learn. He must not take a bondman for apprentice. The apprentice must be of lawful blood and have his limbs whole, to make the Lord for his apprentice as much as his fellows. Number 7, he shall accept no thief for an apprentice, lest he would turn the craft to shame. Any man of craft be not also perfect, he may him change. That's number 8. Any man of craft be not also perfect, he may him change. Number 9, he must undertake no work, but, quote, he can both hide and make. No master shall supplant another, but be as sister and brother. He must be both fair and free, and teach by his might. He shall not disparage his fellow's work, but it amend. I'm having a problem with the word it. It's spelled H-Y-T. He shall not disparage his fellow's work, but it amend. So it, rather than disparage a bit of work, starting off with what one of those old blisters, that's not how it's done. Yeah, blow it out your shorts. That's when you, if you want somebody to stop listening to you, start your conversation with, that's not how it's done. There you go. Then you're giving somebody a little brain vacation. They're drifting off. They're thinking of a nice icy margarita. But show how to amend it. You know, perhaps if you thought about this, maybe if he went, had you thought about this? He must teach his apprentice, says section 13, so that he, when it's his turn, may understand the diverse points and learn. I'm really trying to translate the ancient. These guys are saying this was made more readable. Oh, yeah, maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning after I've been up sipping Kool-Aid all night. And the 5th thing, do nothing that would turn the craft to shame. Then there's 15 points for the craftsman. That was the point for the master mason. Must love well God and church and his master and fellows. This is for craftsmen. Work truly for hours, work upon day and holidays. Must keep his master's counsel in chamber and in lodge. No man is its craft be false. To his craft be false. He must accept their pay meekly from the master and not strive. It's not like, gimme, 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 you know. No man to his craft be false. You don't be slagging it. You don't be undermining it. That's what they're saying. Must accept that they're paid meekly. Must stand well in God's law. You know, be respectful of the laws of your faith. Respect the chastity of his master's wife and his fellow's concubine. Be a true mediator and act fairly to all. To pay well and truly to man and woman. Disobedient masons to be dealt with by the assembly and forfeit membership in the craft. Help one another by instructing those deficit in knowledge and skill. Imprisonment for disobedience to the assembly. He shall swear never to be no thief and never to help any of false craft. So if you get a charlatan, you're not going to help them. Swear to be true to the king. Must obey the assembly on pain of having to forsake the craft and suffer imprisonment. The poem ends with amen and amen. So mote it be. So say we all, per charity, for charity. Now, we did get into the notion of what charity meant, didn't we? Charity was, did I talk to you about that yet? Thank you, Andrew Hammer. Charity, here I had thought that it was about the giving, alms. But I'm learning that that wasn't the term at all. That term, for what I think is, you know, helping somebody, giving somebody aid, not benevolence, but, you know, oh yeah, benevolence. I thought that was what was meant by charity, but, dear, it turns out that the highest form of charity is like agape. It's this form of love, that honor that transcends all, that appreciation, that caring, that connectivity that is transcendent. That's the highest step on the ladder. Man, that set me. Well, it didn't set me back. It was like, oh, that explains a few things. So, in other words, I can't buy my way to the top. If I cut a check, it's not about being charity. Of course, then it made me think that there are, you know, I'm committed to performing charitable acts. Yeah, I like to help. I've been privileged financially, so I have to help where I can. It's only proper. If I have a dollar and somebody needs 10 cents of it, well, there you go. I'll make do. If somebody's just feather bedding and not lifting a hand to help themselves, I'm not so inclined. I'm making some sorry excuse, you know. It's the difference between excuse and truth, I guess. It's in the eye of the beholder. Anyway, that highest act. Faith, hope, and charity. Charity. No, do they give us a manual to explain this? Well, our ancients are saying, well, we tried to make this readable for you. We dumbed it down for you, Dale. For God's sakes, man. You know, what do we have to do? Hit you over the head with a square and compasses? No. Sometimes I'm thick. I'm talking here to the great architect. You gentlemen don't mind. Sometimes a little slow on the uptake. It takes me a while to get around to this stuff. Charity is this act of unrequited love. Oh, yes, well, are we a victim of circumstance? We can't think of love without it, thinking of it in terms of the sexualized form of love. Well, all right, so I look at that nice and objectively in terms of biological function. Without some form of sex, my species dies out. Not exactly titillating. Well, I suppose after the age of what, 12 or 13 years old, or 16 or 18 years old, is it time can I actually set that kind of crap aside? So this is the highest effort. And you know yourself when you meet one of the old Masons that just influences us this way. It's a presence. It's his atmosphere. And now we're finding out, even from the old manuscripts. So say we all for charity. We do all of these things. And the charity, the key to me, the key that made that work wasn't like, well, what does that have to do with benevolence? What does that have to do with charity in the vernacular, the way we often use the term? And some people use that meagerly. They use the term something for nothing. Why should I help? You know, we've seen that discussion going on down in the south, southern part of the continent. Why should I help somebody out with their health care? Why should I do that? Well, here in Canada, if we get caught up in that, it's like the idea, why do we sometimes let the guilty, seem to let the guilty go? Why do we live by the rule of law instead of the rule of vengeance? Because better to release 1,000 guilty people than to condemn one innocent man. Huh. Common lie. And are we willing to live by that? Well, 1,000 criminals may mock us, but they have no understanding of what it takes. They couldn't create the kind of world that we lived in. They couldn't create the world of a nation of laws. They couldn't do it. They crawl around in the mud, living a life in the gutter with no pride, no dignity, chasing what? What they call power? There's no power in that. They're mocked. They're mocked everywhere. When they walk away, they're mocked. And the intelligent among them know it. The rest, why would we talk to somebody that doesn't have the ability to reason through what we're saying? We wouldn't. Those people don't come to the door of masonry. I heard of one fellow once saying, well, if we, you know, we were talking about whether we should, somebody that had a criminal record for doing very bad things, should we hold that against him? Well, that, in his point was, well, you know, the person is rehabilitated, the person paid the price. And I'm thinking that person's history brings shame to our order. It was disappointing to think, you know. Enough. So we've talked about a little bit about the Gothic Constitution. So when you're out and about, if you hear somebody offering a talk on them, you might find that it was very, you know, you might want to show up. Who knows who you might see there. Through 6 centuries, not bad work, boys. Thank you very much for helping us get where we are today. We couldn't have got here. Truly, we couldn't have got here without you. Now, how do we wind this up? I don't know. It's really hard to wind up these shows. I mean, there's just times when it's just too much going on masonically, too much to be able to say, well, that's the end of it. You know, I just want to arbitrarily cut it off. It's almost like the conversation that, you know, you learn a little bit and then it influences your thinking. Examinations, here's our friend Billy Leslie. Examination of the text of the opening and closing of the lodge in the third degree discloses the whole of the philosophy upon which the Masonic system is reared. Upon which. Now, in the old days, we can only, you know, we're hearing there's a resurgence, there's some interest, and why are the leaders of our world not joining Freemasonry the way they did, may have done in the past. But I hear, I want you to tolerate me just for a second. You know, I'm having one of those, you know, my mind has wandered again, so I need your advice to bring me back to reality. Today, I think the type of person that thrives in Freemasonry are sort of the geeks that have a bit of personality, have some personality, thoughtful, the scientists, the academics. I think it appeals, a bit of personality, and very cool people that have a bit of a brain in their head, you know. The days have changed. What was considered necessary for leadership in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century isn't the same anymore. Oh, it's probably there, but you know, they didn't have as much history to fall back on as we do. And we are influenced by that history a bit. It helps us, and we abuse it. It's not always used in a good way. We abuse our history. We can extrapolate meaning and distort meaning. And we've seen that repeatedly. The fellow that comes forward comes from what's in the day when our order started, there wasn't such a thing as the middle class. The middle class seems to has was
was produced by an affluence that let working men have more control over their more wage than they needed to survive, so that they could begin to buy things that were wants, not necessarily needs. So you think about back in the day when people that weren't born to advantage had to struggle to survive, to meet their basic needs, is what that means. And then there came a time when people could make a little bit of what we call profit, and they could then, we developed banking systems. Now, okay, if you want to say that, anyway, I won't get into it. My mind was straying there into something to do with banking systems, but it also became the part of society that sought the benefits, or recognized the benefits of living with rules, with laws. Here in Canada, if you notice, the wealthy tend to abuse the rules as we know them, okay? And our privileged political leaders tend to stretch and abuse and then rationalize what they've done. Is there different rules? Obviously there are. But it was the middle class that really emphasized the fact that life had to go on according to the rule book. And yeah, it can be tedious at times. Yes, of course. But it is a force to be reckoned with, because the middle is just what it is. There is this organization below it, and there is people that are privileged above it that largely are dependent on what they have by exploiting and taking advantage. So the middle class is the arbiters. They're the sort of that group, that large group that keep, that maintain accountability. And the threat today is that the middle class around the world are shrinking. And there are governments that realize that without the middle class, instability follows. So different times. So we're different today than we were then. We're not likely to go back to that point. But what we have today is the ability for a boy like me, born in Prince Edward Island to fishermen and farmers and blacksmiths, to have access to the finest arts and sciences, to the work of the finest minds in the world. I have access. I can sit down in the privacy of my own home and listen to some of the best music in the world. I don't have to be a king to hear Mozart. I don't have to be a royalty to hear Haydn. It's a privilege. And that is where I think Masonry is founded. That's the foundation of Masonry today and moving forward. That's a very strong and significant but different group. Now, if you are, I'm not saying that this is the only way of looking at it, but it helps me to explain and understand a little bit about what's going on. Now, you can, I'm going to say goodbye to you again for another week. I'm very sorry to do that. I've absolutely enjoyed our time together and hope I've been useful in some ways. You can hear my enthusiasm about things like the Gothic constitutions being the ancient charges. But, I'm a boy of the 60s, so bear with me. Commit lots of acts of random kindness. Here's one of the little secrets that we don't like to admit, that some of us were born in the 60s, eh? See you next week. In the meantime, take good care of yourselves and each other. Oh, you knew it was a matter of time before I got around to that. That's fun.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do you
my boy. See you soon.